This episode of The Kick Around is brought to you by Soccer 90. Now, soccer90.com is your outstanding resource online to go find soccer gear for clubs and national teams from all over the globe. And don't forget, there's an actual store. If you're up in Frisco, right there next door to the Hall of Fame, right there on Main Street, is actual Soccer 90 brick and mortar store that you need to go in and shop because you get to see all this stuff and it's awesome to see in person. But if you want to just shop online, soccer90.com is the place, and this week is of particular interest because they're going to be having the USA flash sale promos that will be coming up during the men's national team World Cup qualification matches, 30% off USA gear online only. They also now have new arrivals from Tottenham Hotspur, AC Milan, Manchester City jerseys, and yes, PSG jerseys with Messi names on the back and Ronaldo Manchester United jerseys. It's soccer90.com, and please don't forget, when you're done shopping at checkout, use the code KICKAROUND to get 25% off your order. Go check it out, soccer90.com.
It's time for the Kick Around, the Ticket's weekly show all about soccer. 2 hours of HSOs on the clubs, leagues, and tournaments of the world's game. It doesn't matter if you're new to the sport, don't worry. This is the Ticket. We're just kicking it around. Now, here's two guys hoping for short shorts to come back in style. Andy Swift and Peter Welpton.
Howdy ho, P1s, and welcome to today's Kick Around. Now, normally, Saturdays 2 to 4 here on Sports Radio 96.7 and 1310 The Ticket, but today is different because the Kick Around this weekend and probably for next weekend has been bullied out of the way by collegiate football. The mighty SMU Mustangs broadcast are taking precedent. So that means we are going to cover our favorite sport via the podcast. Hi, my name is Peter. Who am I kidding? If you're listening to this, you know who I am. Welcome to the podcast edition of the Kick Around. Now, joining me normally is my soccer-talking BFF, Andy Swift, but he's very busy this weekend. It was a very highfalutin weekend of United States Soccer Hall of Fame inductions and things like that. So, you know, Andy's very busy doing that, so he was unavailable today. But joining me to talk about this weekend's action in the Premier League is my friend and yours, all the way live from London, England, our favorite Norwegian, Lars Sivertsen. Hello, Lars.
Hello, everyone. Delighted to be here yet again. Usually when we do this on the radio, you have like applause and stuff in the background. There's no applause now. I'm already slightly put out by that. There we go.
I don't have the drop.
Genuine applause, not just push button applause. This is good. I'm hyped now.
This is my applause for you, Lars.
And I've become such a diva doing this show with you. Like the first time I was just excited like a puppy to be on, and now I demand applause.
And you don't get any of that type of treatment from The Guardian, do you?
No, actually, I almost got booed when going on stage for a live show. that was unexpected.
You know what? If you ever do make your way to Dallas, we'll do a live show here in Dallas. We'll figure that out.
That'd be amazing.
Wouldn't that
be fun?
Amazing.
Yeah, just hook it all up in a bar or something with the football on in the background or something. It would be fantastic.
We'll do that. Now, what's the only kind of silver lining to the fact that we didn't get to do our radio show this week is the fact that we pushed the recording of this podcast to late Sunday afternoon, which means we actually get to cover the entire weekend's slate of matches, including today's massive tilt, the one everybody was waiting for, Liverpool hosting Manchester City, and you know what, Lars? I think this one lived up to the billing.
It was a great game, wasn't it? And it was, for the first half, because I knew we were doing this, and I knew we'd be talking about this game a lot. And for the first half, I thought, okay, for listeners of the radio show, are we going to have another conversation about a top game in this league where we're talking all about how tactically it was interesting rather
you
than
mean a tactical bore fest.
Yeah, it was a bit of a tactical battle in the first half, and I was kind of starting to go through in my head what we'd say about this game. And actually, I think in terms of the there are good games and good games. I would still maintain that watching the first half as a football aficionado, you would have been enjoying the quality on show. Like, the technical quality of these teams are extraordinary. But what I felt for the first half, really for the first hour of the game, up until the first goal, was that these are two teams who have a lot of respect for each other. These are two teams who are maybe scared gives the wrong impression, but there are two teams who are very aware of what the other team can do to them.
Yeah.
I think that was the vibe I was getting. Both yeah. teams were a little bit worried about opening up because they're very keenly aware of what could happen if they do.
Yeah, what I was interested, you know, it's funny because last week we talked about, or maybe it was 2 weeks ago, I don't remember how long ago it was, we talked about how the Man City-Chelsea game was boring because it was this tactical battle. But this was, as you say, also a tactical battle, but for reasons I don't know why in my head, and maybe you can help me explain it, this one wasn't boring, maybe because I was just waiting for Phil Foden to make dinner out of James Milner. But there was something different, and part of it was that Liverpool seemed really, really timid and not themselves in the first half, and you just had this weird sense that City was just about to open up and end this thing very quickly.
Yeah, because Liverpool under Jurgen Klopp, I mean, they have evolved a little bit over the years. It's not just all heavy metal and let's run at them. But they are still a team that, at their best, is all about the energy and the intensity and the running. And I think they were... We were discussing this during the game. Are they looking a little bit lethargic? But I wonder if they were just holding back a little bit, because all this sort of let's all run forward stuff, it does give the opponent quite a few opportunities to counter against you. And if you're playing Man City, that is a scary thing. So I wonder if they were keeping the handbrake on a little bit, Liverpool, for a while here, and try to make it a slightly more controlled game. Whereas it wasn't quite as if Man City were sort of swamping them the way they did Chelsea. It wasn't as if they weren't able to get out. But Liverpool were not committing men forward in quite the same way we've seen them do. I think having Milner at right back, who at his age, he has to worry a little bit about what happens the other way. So he maybe can't attack as much as he wants to. I thought Jordan Henderson didn't have a very good game. I thought it kind of passed him by a little bit. And I wonder if they all... I think it was, it's not fair, might not be the right word, but the amount of respect they have for City and the dangers they pose meant that they weren't sort of flying forwards and flying right at them the way we often see Liverpool do. And it meant they weren't, they didn't actually create much. But you're right, Phil Foden was doing things. Salah always looked sharp.
Sure.
And really his work for the first goal is really, really good. And then we'll get to the second goal. But I mean, it was for a while a little bit cagey. And then I think the first goal opens it up a bit, because when Liverpool get that first goal, great work by Mohamed Salah. His sort of touch and his ability, his close control is extraordinary. And I thought the way to pass to Mane was really, really good as well. And then when you're 1-0 up, City have to kind of come out and play, and that opens it up again, and it became a much more exciting game.
One of the things that you and I were kind of discussing back and forth via chat at the beginning of the game was that Pep was doing Pep Guardiola things again with his lineup and making personnel decisions that make all of us that follow this sport scratch our heads and go, how does he get away with this all the time? It was funny, here in the States, for the NBC broadcast, they were showing the lineups, and they always have a graphic where they put everybody in the formation, and they had created this really weird formation for City that had, it was almost like a 4-2-1-3 kind of thing, but De Bruyne was sitting somewhere between the lines, slightly off to the left and behind. It was weird. It made me laugh out loud. And it turned out to be nothing like what they actually played in the game. But you were surprised at who he didn't include in the starting 11.
Well, I mean, given that he's not been involved in the last couple of games, I guess maybe it isn't a surprise. But I find the sort of sudden disappearance of Ferran Torres very strange, even by Pep Guardiola's standards.
Right.
Now, in fantasy football terms, they refer to it as the Pep roulette. It's like if you on your fantasy team have, if your fantasy English Premier League team, if you have Man City players, like, you're never safe. Like, there's always a chance he'll just bench them for completely unexpected and weird reasons. But usually... And Ferran Torres have fallen prey to this. So it's slightly selfish of me. I have Ferran Torres in my team. I moved him in 3 weeks ago, or 3 match days ago, and he's played a total of 0 minutes since then. So that's been a huge success for me, having been a regular up until then. But the thing is, that's obviously a personal frustration of mine. But it is slightly odd, because he was really thriving in this new role as a striker, or to the extent that you ever have a striker in a Pep team, but as the sort of focal point in the middle. And that's an unexpected thing. Because he was a proper winger before, but they moved him into a new position. He was really working out well. He scored 2 goals against Arsenal, and then suddenly he's dropped, and he's not. And it's very strange. And I haven't seen any sort of statements about it. But this is what Guardiola does. And it might seem from the outside as it's just sort of strange behavior. But Guardiola, like, no one's ever accused him of underthinking something. Like, he'll have a theory here. If we had him on the line, obviously, maybe there's more important things to ask him. But I'm sure he could have spent a good half hour explaining the exact theory behind not playing Ferran Torres. Like, there's always a completely logical reason for these things. But it is, from the outside, I can't quite sort of come to grips with it currently. But the way they set up in the end I do always have to consult the heat maps to make sure, but it was Gabriel Jesus on the right and Phil Foden on the left, and then Jack Grealish in kind of a false nine, but kind of allowed to drift all over the place as he felt like it.
But he was kind of really ineffective this game. I mean, the Jack Grealish experience is still very much underway.
Yes. I'm kind of intrigued by this mix. Foden from the left, you know, doing his things and potentially cutting in. And I think the Jack Grealish false nine thing, I think it can work and can be a pretty cool way of doing it. But it's a very new role for him and it's very different. And it is just life at City for Jack Grealish. It's very different from Aston Villa, where the whole game plan was, whenever the team gets the ball, find Jack Grealish somehow, and his job would have been then to progress it up the field, go past the guy, maybe win a free kick, do something. Now he's part of a collective that has the ball most of the time, and it's very, very different for him.
Right, but putting Jack Grealish in a position that he's never played, that I'm aware of, ever, is either A, the most Pep Guardiola thing ever, or B, Sunday League field manager guy just giving it a go.
No, I think that he has a plan, and I think one of the things about Grealish is that he is someone who does. He's used to being able to drift around. He's used to not having a very fixed position, and when you give him a sort of nominal false nine position, and I don't know, I can't read everyone's brain. I don't know exactly what his role was, but he seemed to have a license to roam, to put it mildly. But that's in the end, that's kind of close to what he was doing at Villa in a way, because he was kind of moving around all about the place. And I think that's a position he could thrive in for sure. But it might need some time to settle, basically.
So the game kind of gets underway, as you talked about, Liverpool. I don't think it's unfair to say somewhat against the run of play, take the lead.
Yeah, definitely against the run of play.
Okay, I mean, I want to be sensitive to those.
I mean, they'd had three shots all game. At that point, they hadn't created anything really, and there was a sense that City were kind of, you know, not playing at their best, maybe not moving the ball as fast as they can, but they would eventually get there, you kind of thought. And the sort of Phil Foden versus James Milner thing had already started happening, and you already thought that could go wrong. I mean, I was pondering a bet on James Milner being sent off.
Well, so Foden does end up equaling the game, making it 1-1, and then we have the incident.
Yeah.
So Milner's already on a yellow. He's already. Did you think he got away with the non-call at the top of the box?
Yeah. No. That's. The one at the top of the box. That should have been a foul.
Okay.
But it wasn't a penalty. It was just outside the box, and it wasn't a straight red because it wasn't a clear goal scoring opportunity.
And it wasn't in the box, so VAR can't review it.
So VAR can't look at it. Yeah. So it's a frustrating one. But he should have had a second yellow. That's in the game.
Talk about that real quick. So, because this is real, I mean, this is going to get talked about a lot this week. So Milner is over on the sideline. I don't even know who the player was that he ended up fouling, reaching out backwards. Who did he foul on that play? I don't remember who it was. Whoever it was is really not important. But anyway, a City player has a ball out on the edge, cuts back inside. Milner's in trying to just stop it, sticks a leg out behind, clearly fouls the guy. I don't think did they even call a foul on that play?
Yeah, I double-checked. It was Bernardo Silva.
It was Silva.
Who had a great game, by the way, which is someone else who's been the victim of sort of bizarro Pep Guardiola just being on the bench for ages for no reason, and suddenly he comes back and plays really well. But no, it must have been a foul. Either way, it was a very clear second yellow card.
It was.
And I think this was a case of, I don't know, slightly weak refereeing, because it's... you know, sending off James Milner at a very important game, at a very sort of sensitive point in the game stage and everything, away at Anfield, it does require some testicular fortitude on behalf of the ref, and I think he lacked it in this case.
Pep Guardiola, we've seen him freak out and lose his mind on the sideline pretty good over the years, but this is one of the better freak out moments in a Guardiola.
Yeah, I nearly wrote something about this on social media, but decided not to just because I was having a quiet afternoon and I didn't want my mentions to go crazy with angry City fans. But, you know, as much as that clearly was a red card that should have happened and didn't happen, the injustice was almost worth it just for the fun of seeing Guardiola just go completely mad. I mean, he's a very passionate guy, and we shouldn't make fun of him for that. But, you know, he does freak outs like few others when he's angry.
Yeah, unfortunately for him...
I think he was slightly lucky not to get sent off, actually.
Well, I was going to say, unfortunately for him, Mike Dean was the fourth official who's, you know, not the guy that you want to get into it with because, well, you know how that goes with Mike Dean.
Well, Mike Dean is a ref who's always very keenly aware when he figures he's probably on TV, and you can see him sort of, there are clips now on the internet where you can see him standing in the background just completely deadpanning and very consciously, I think, making no reaction at all to the sort of the Guardiola hopping madness happening in front of him. and especially Mike Dean always, he's one of those referees, he always knows if he's on TV, and he clearly did here. You can find this online if you're looking for it.
Yeah, I my favorite part of this entire exchange is when Guardiola is told to go back to the bench and he throws himself into the chair like a five-year-old kid told to go sit in the corner, and he throws a hissy fit, and then he takes his jacket off and he puts, it was good stuff. And then of course, just minutes, I don't know, maybe even seconds later, we have one of the best goals you will ever see. Mohamed Salah just absolutely makes breakfast out of, what, 4, 5 City defenders and a finish that is one for the ages.
Yeah, he's incredible, and he's playing some of his best football now. And I wonder if this is one of those where we've kind of gotten used to how good he is. I mean, he's been there since 2017. He's on his fifth season. That's one, two, three, four, five. Yeah, he'll be on his fifth season for Liverpool. And... you know, I think we almost, I mean, I know he's a global superstar and we talk a lot about him and we're talking about it now, but I think there's an extent to which he's almost taken a little bit for granted. And I also think maybe because he didn't quite, I mean, he came to England and scored 32 in his first season, which is unbelievable, and added 10 assists to that, crazy numbers. And then he's followed that up with 22, 19 and 22 goals, which is incredibly good for a sort of goal scoring wide player. But I wonder if because he didn't quite sort of he's not been scoring sort of Ronaldo Messi numbers, it's been seen as not, if we underappreciated a little bit because he had that first season when he was completely right. Unstoppable. Either way, he's got 6 in 7 games now and 3 in 2 in the Champions League, and what he does today is the close control, the acceleration, the balance. And the finish as well. I mean, he gets to right because he does miss a few chances because he's so good at getting himself into good positions. But the finish is really like this. There are not many like millimeters of goal where you can put that ball on the foot that he has to shoot from. It's an incredibly difficult finish to pull off, and it's really a quite extraordinary goal.
Well, so it ends up, at least for those who were hoping to keep the race nice and tight, it works out well because with the draw, Liverpool still sits at second place with 15 points. City is in that group of teams just a point behind with 14 points. But I'm going to guess that Liverpool fans are going to feel a little disappointed that they didn't end up winning that game based on how they had gotten with the Salah goal, because the goal late to tie it up is probably the most disappointing part of the game for Liverpool fans.
Yeah, when you get to that point. But also, I mean, I think both sets of fans will be frustrated because Man City fans will rightly feel that James Milner should have been sent off.
Sure.
And they should have had a man extra. Whereas you're right, Liverpool fans feel when you do score that extraordinary, like one of the goals of the season, you think, all right, fine, we got this now. We got this. 3 huge points. So then conceding an equalizer that I feel like should have been avoided somehow, then that is slightly frustrating. But it's a draw, and at least, you know, it becomes almost, we're expecting these two teams to go all the way in the title fight, possibly accompanied by Chelsea. I think, I certainly think that's how it'll play out. And in that way, it's almost like a zero-sum game. Like, it's almost as important that City don't get those extra points than that you get them, you know?
Sure,
The tie there will do them just fine.
Yeah, knocking each other level through those two games and then just getting all your points somewhere else is probably the goal here. Just not, because, you know, if you lose to City, it's a 6-point loss, right?
Exactly, right. That's how it's going to pan out, I think.
It's a really big deal. Now Lars, you and I haven't known each other very long, and I don't know if you're aware of this, but I'm really into noticing noticing little odd things that are non-related to on the field stuff. And one of the things that I continue to be mystified this season is the coaching field jacket worn by Liverpool coaches, specifically Klopp. Now, have you spotted these yet? They're the big field jackets with the oversized Nike logo on the back that's so big that it doesn't actually exist in its entirety. Like, it goes over the seam, so you only see like 80% of the Nike swoosh.
I must say that is not something I have noticed.
Yes. Well, here's the weirder part. Today, when they were showing up close views of it, it has this weird pattern in the background of different logos. I think one of them's the liver bird, and another one's almost like a fleur-de-lis, and another one is something else. And I'm telling you, that jacket looks like a weird mashup between a Nike and Louis Vuitton ripoff that you'd buy from a weird store in Times Square somewhere.
Yeah, I'm looking at it now. It's a strange one. Yeah.
Isn't that a weird jacket?
It isn't something I'd look at and said, yes, that's something I want to wear. That isn't really my thought process if I saw it hanging at the store, I have to admit.
Yeah, this is probably content you don't typically discuss with other people on soccer podcasts.
Maybe Klopp can make it into a thing. No, you'd be surprised. I mean, I'm a bad podcaster in that sense, because I'm not as interested in jerseys and design and stuff, except I get the sort of old man rage if I think they're very bad, like the recent ones that didn't have the badge on them and just said Paris for PSG and stuff like this. Is like, you need to burn it with fire, you know, this sort of stuff. If it's very bad, I get very cross. But aside from that, I have no opinion, which is not useful in this sort of setting when we're talking about this.
The last thing that I'll talk about this game was an exchange between you and I where we were watching it, was the Ted Lasso trick play by Pep Guardiola. Yes.
Well, I mean,
what is going on there?
I just thought this was a moment of in what was an extremely high quality. See, this is the kind of thing I notice. Stuff that I find inexplicably funny, and then I have to try to explain to people why it was funny, and sometimes they agree, sometimes they don't. I thought it was really funny late in the game. The game was really cooking. The tempo had gone up. You know, the technical quality was so high, man. You know, some of the stuff we saw was so good. And then you have a moment where Manchester City have a free kick, and it's pretty far out. It's not a big chance, really. But you do have Kevin De Bruyne standing over it. You have Phil Foden standing over it. You know, two people who can deliver a ball with just incredible precision. And you wonder which one of them's going to take them. You know, can De Bruyne do something from here? You know, who knows? And then suddenly, like, Kyle Walker runs up and just kicks the ball into orbit, basically, just way the heck. It's not even close.
So
to anything.
Weird.
And then the camera just pans to him, going, well, "I don't know." Like, I went for it, which is like, "Okay, Kyle."
It was like they owed him or something. Like, "Oh wait, that's right. We told Kyle he could take a free kick from 45 yards." So
he does.
It's very strange.
I mean, I have seen him hit the ball well. He scored like one or two long shots for Tottenham back in the day, but I mean, it's not very often. He was, you know, believe it or not, Kyle Walker was a striker when he was a young player, when he was teenager.
No way.
He was a striker who was retooled as a defender.
Aren't it pretty much at this day and age, isn't everybody that's playing at the highest level at one point in their young career a striker?
And they've been repurposed. It's quite common, actually, yeah, because when you're very talented as a kid, the youth coaches will just, yeah, put you up front, score some goals for us. So that is true. But I think with Walker as well, it was because he's very speedy. It's a combination of being very fast and also being quite big. So you put him up front to torment the other children, I suppose.
Yeah.
But I know this because he told me. I've interviewed him ages ago, actually, and he told me this. We used to do a question when I worked for Norwegian TV to just sort of break the tension sometimes. If you could only eat one meal, every meal for the rest of your life, what would it be? And Kyle Walker, I feel cheated, and said an entire Sunday roast.
Oh, jeez.
Which is like a number of different things. It wouldn't. And also, it's very like, is that something you'd go for every meal? It's, I don't know, man.
That's quite a meal, Kyle Walker. Okay, so that
Arteta
game.
Said sushi, by the way.
No, that doesn't surprise
very,
me.
Very, very tidy man.
Liverpool 2, Manchester City 2. Man, what a great game. If you haven't watched it, go pull it up on Peacock and rewatch it. It's totally worth your time, especially for the Salah goal. It lived up to the billing, no doubt about it. Now, the other big game... go ahead.
What you can do to make it easier, rewatch the last half hour, like from the last... from about the 55th minute,
sure,
thereabout.
Yeah. That's not a bad shout.
You get the good stuff. Before that, it was a little bit sort of... touchy-feely, you know, I'm a bit worried about you counterattacking. Let's just kind of keep it clear. But after that, it went slightly mad, and it's really one of the most enjoyable games of the season so far.
It was a good one. Now, moving over to the other team in Manchester, the big talking point this weekend was the... So first off, let me ask you this question. Does any coach that has to play a European game on a Wednesday and then is scheduled to play the early kickoff game on Saturday have a reason to complain?
I mean, on the one hand, you can say these clubs have all the money in the world and they have really deep squads, so just deal with it. Like, nobody cares. I mean, that is one reply to it that's very tempting. Though I am slightly sympathetic to the fact that, from the coach's perspective, like, why couldn't we have been the late game or the early game on Sunday? Like, why early
Saturday?
Well,
that's what they normally do, right?
Yeah, yes. Now, it is actually to do with broadcasting contracts in the UK and which networks have first pick for which slots and stuff. So BT Sport, which was the broadcaster for this in the UK, they have second pick for any round. So obviously the first pick for this weekend will have been Liverpool Man City, which Sky had, and because Sky has bought the rights, well, they have the rights for a number of time slots, they can kind of put it where they want to put it. But BT have that early Saturday slot for their live game, and they have second pick for that one. And that ended up being Manchester United Everton.
Which is the game
boring and nerdy reason for it.
Yeah, that's the match we're talking about. United and Everton coming off the heels of the dramatic late minute winner by Ronaldo on Wednesday night against Villarreal in the Champions League. Weird, surprising lineup that I don't think. I mean, we talk about Guardiola throwing out an odd 11, the Solskjaer 11 on Saturday morning here in the States was threw everybody for a loop.
Yeah, it did. Now, just add as well, we had a controversy about this last year because Jurgen Klopp went berserk and got really angry with the reporter from the broadcaster, like, about why do you make us play on this early night?
I remember.
But I feel like this is something I can understand. It's to do with contracts and, you know, where how you get the most viewers and this sort of thing. I just feel like this is something they could have solved quite easily by just going to the broadcaster and say, hey, this is a bit bad for the clubs. How can we work this out? Anyway, it hasn't been worked out. BT are still picking the games they want to pick because that's what they're contractually allowed to do and that's what they've paid for. So here we are. Yeah, slightly rogue 11 from Solskjaer, which I think, again... I know what you're saying, but if you look at this team, this is a team that should beat Everton. You're playing Everton,
sure.
who are missing Calvert-Lewin and Richarlison. So it's like their entire attack is gone, and their entire first choice attack anyway. Some other guys who aren't there, like Seamus Coleman's not around, Andre Gomes is injured. You know, Delph isn't there. Everton have got some serious injury lists here. Sigurdsson is not available, and whereas you look at that United 11, yeah, there's no Ronaldo, there's no Pogba starting, but come on, you've got a front four of like Cavani, Bruno Fernandes, and then Mason Greenwood and Martial. Like, I know Martial has become a bit of a punchline, but he's still, you know, theoretically a good player, and you've got McFred, which is probably your best midfield two to begin with anyway.
Oh,
so,
Lars,
so
McFred. Here's the thing. This is what I want to talk about, because this is the, I think when you talk about McFred,
I've been on the internet.
Right. This is the issue, which is, if you look, if you want, I try to explain this to my friends who are like, what's, you know, who aren't into the sport or whatever, what's the difference between City and United? And one of the big glaring differences for me is that Pep Guardiola has drilled into his midfielders, if we get caught in a defensive transition, you need to stop whatever is happening, no matter how what it takes. And you need to do it in the middle of the field, and you can do it with a little tiny foul here or a big foul there, whatever it takes, and don't let these things blossom into bigger problems. And on that particular play against Everton, Fred in particular has not one, but two, along with Juan Bissaka, and then Lindelof, and then Shaw, and at least one other person have an opportunity to kill that counterattack by Everton, and none of them do it. They all try to play the ball. None of them just take the little foul to stop it, and that, to me, is one of the bigger differences between how those two teams are coached.
Well, so, yeah. Guardiola and Man City obviously play in a very particular way, very front foot, you know, commit a lot of men high up the field and dominate possession. And underpinning everything that Guardiola does is something called the 5-second rule, which is when they lose the ball, they try, everyone who's anywhere near where the ball is should press and try to win it back. And if they haven't won it in the first 5 seconds, they should basically commit a foul.
Right.
just to stop whatever's going on so everyone can regroup. That is the sort of fun. And their first season, a few years back, there was a really interesting interview with his former assistant, Dominic Turan, who worked in the MLS for a while for New York.
Yeah, yeah.
Where he explained that in his first season in England, Guardiola, his biggest problem was making sure it was completely ingrained in the players' minds that when we lose the ball, we don't immediately run back. Actually, we run towards the ball. Because it's one of the first things you learn as a footballer. You've lost the ball, now everyone has to get back in defense. Like, it's so hardwired into your brain. Whereas with Guardiola, the way he plays, it's super important that they either win the ball back immediately or stop whatever's happening. So you need to teach everyone that actually when you lose the ball, you're not going back, you're going towards the ball. And everyone has to do that 100% of the time for the system to work. So I don't think you'll see an Ole Gunnar Solskjaer coached Manchester United be that extreme with the counter-pressing. But you are completely right. I completely agree with the idea that the goal they conceded against Everton is something that it's not even about having this kind of 5-second rule. It's just about being smart.
Yeah.
It's just about realizing, uh-oh, we're being countered on here. We've got some people who are out of position. This could be bad. I'm going to take one for the team here and just stop him. Even if it means picking up a yellow card, you know, that's part of a job, especially as a midfielder.
Everything else about United continues to look really clunky and slow. They appear to allow defenses to reorganize way too quickly. And we didn't see Ronaldo until later in the game. And Pogba until later in the game, and Sancho until later in the game. But no matter what mix of players it was, and again, this is all the reason why we talk about this is because it begins to get into the question of how much longer Solskjaer is going to be the manager of this team, which is it almost seems no matter what the team they're playing, whether it's a really, really good side or it's a bottom of the table side, it almost seems too easy to slow this team down and create problems for them.
Yeah, so across the season so far, United's results haven't been so all bad, but I think I've seen all their games, actually. And I would only say they played well against Leeds in the opening game.
And that
was against the Marcelo Bielsa team, who leave you a lot of space to counter into, and it was perfect for the fast attackers of United. We've seen it before. And in every other game, okay, they've had some okay periods, especially against Newcastle United, when Newcastle kind of gave up. But apart from that, in every single game, even the wins, there have been prolonged periods of time where they've just looked like a bit of a mess, and the opponents have attacked, have had, you know, too much space to attack. And it does make my brain explode a little bit, because I feel like I'm about to say things that we've been saying for 2 years now, and I think we have been saying them for 2 years. It is the whole thing that they don't look like they have a plan. The players don't look like what they know what they're supposed to do when they have the ball. And it's a criticism that I think Ole Gunnar Solskjaer knows about now and is familiar with, because he specifically said to the media recently that they are, you know, working on attacking patterns in training and stuff. It's just, it doesn't look like that's something they're working on. Because constantly when you watch United play, I mean, again, the compare and contrast Manchester United's attacking game with Man City's, for instance. You can see quite clearly, now they're not complete automatons, but there are certain patterns. You know, when that guy has the ball, you're meant to run here, and then you're meant to pass to him. Like the sort of almost like plays that you see in the NFL. It's increasingly becoming a thing in elite level football, because the tempo of the game is so high and teams are quite well organized and physically very good. So if you're going to open them up, you need passing combinations that are executed so quickly and so precisely that you can't just leave it up to the players to figure it out. You need to have certain patterns to fall back on. It's something that Bielsa does a lot. I saw an interview with Patrick Bamford of Leeds, the striker, who said that he, in one game, found himself making a pass and making one, and whilst he was doing it, he realized, right, that's the thing we've been working on in training, that exact move I just did. So it's not like they go out with a playbook like in NFL, but they have certain movements that they work on a lot in training to the point they can execute it without even realizing that's what they're doing. It's just because those are the movements they're used to doing. And I don't know what goes on in training for Man United. Maybe Solskjaer is doing everything correct by the book and it's just not being executed well on the field. That's possible.
Yeah.
But what we can see from observers is that this team constantly look like they have no idea what they're meant to do when they have possession. It's like, let's give the ball to him and see if he does something. Oh, let's give the ball to him. Maybe he does something, you know? There's no coherence there.
Yeah.
They just look like a collection of bits. And we've been saying this for at least 18 months, possibly as much as 2 years.
They definitely feel like more about the parts than the sum of the parts kind of idea. And
And
we've talked about the fact that I do think a lot of that is Bruno Fernandes and how Bruno plays. And compared to a more organized kind of structure, because he tends to be so creative in the way that he free flowing.
So I will go along with the idea that it would be a challenge to convince Bruno Fernandes to fit into this sort of pattern, because he has his own ideas.
Right.
But I would also say they had this problem before they signed him, and I think he has put over a lot of cracks for them, because when you have a guy who's as good at taking charge creatively, then you get away with not having much of a plan, is how I would put it.
Yes.
And I think United, I mean, Manchester United will win a lot of games this year because the individuals we're talking about are absolutely outstanding. You know, if you have a front four of sort of Fernandes, you know, Sancho, Greenwood, and Cristiano Ronaldo, like, you will score goals. There's no way this team won't score goals. But the concern is, Will they drop too many points along the way? You know, because it's not about just trying to win games for United. You have to win, just put it very simplified, as a United coach, there's a big difference between winning 8 and 9 out of 10 games and winning 6 or 7 out of 10 games. You know, that is the difference between winning the league and not. And I think to become more consistent, they need to be more coherent, basically.
Well, they're still missing a player in midfield. Definitely. That's another conversation for another day, I suppose.
That I think we had last time I was on. Like, they brought a magnificent freestanding bathtub when there is a big hole in the roof.
Right. That's a great analogy. Now, I don't want to do too much of this because it will make our producer Sam too happy, but we do need to give a few minutes of praise to Everton, who continue to surprise this season. There are a lot of surprises so far in this Premier League season, but I think Everton being tied for third is definitely one of those, especially based on Rafa Benitez's recruitment of certain kind of mid-tier players. Mm. But you know what? There they are after 7 games, doing quite well.
Yeah, and I think there is a symbolism here, and it's a slight sort of simplification of things, but last year you had Carlo Ancelotti, who's a big name and a suave man and a likable man, a man of the world, on the sideline. And you had James Rodriguez, you know, Colombian superstar, you know, a huge name, an incredible talent on the field. And this year you have sort of slightly finickety and nerdy Rafa Benitez, and you have like Andros Townsend. And most people will think that that is a big step back, but I would argue for Everton, I think it's a step in the right direction. Because I think Everton, like a lot of sort of mid-tier, mid-market, mid-table teams in every sport in the world, their job above everything, more than everyone else, is that they want to try to find some way of getting more out of less. You know, they can't compete. They want to finish. They want to challenge for the Champions League spots. They want to do this sort of thing, but they can't pay the sort of money that those clubs can. So the job, it becomes Moneyball, right? It becomes the thing. Like, how do we get more out of what we have? And I think, signing a sort of incredibly gifted superstar like James Rodriguez, who can do incredible things, but his motivation is maybe listening, and he maybe doesn't like the weather. That was a rumor that was going on. And certainly there's a lot of games. Like, there was one game where I think one of the goalkeepers had sprinted more than him. There's a lot of that stuff going on.
Well, he ended up in the polar opposite of the weather spectrum, didn't he?
He's gone to the Middle East, and good luck to him. I think that's not right for the position the franchise is in, basically.
Yeah.
And Carlo Ancelotti as well, God bless him. Like, if you had to pick a manager in the world to have over for dinner, though actually you wouldn't want to have him at your house, because just the pressure of cooking for Carlo would be extraordinary. You would have him take you to a restaurant and ideally pick up the bill. Then I think Carlo, because he's an incredibly funny guy. I've said it before on this show that his autobiography is so good. And he's very self-effacing. And one of his sort of motivational strategies when he's coaching Real Madrid and teams like this is to like tell a lot of jokes in the dressing room, because you don't need to fire up those guys. They're already fired up for the games. You need to get them to relax a bit, because the guys who get to that level are usually so driven and motivated that actually you need to calm them down. But basically, he has this sort of laissez-faire approach to management, which if you're in charge of Milan with all the superstars there, if you're in charge of Real Madrid, PSG, it can be really good and work really well. But I think if your challenge is to try to drag Everton from 8th to 6th, I'm not sure that's the way. So they replaced the sort of this sort of approach with Rafa Benitez, who can be a slightly prickly and awkward character, but he's incredibly methodical. He's incredibly thorough. He at least used to have an app that all the players got, where they had like clips sent to them of things to look out for and stuff like this, like the Rafa Benitez app.
The Rafa app.
Yeah.
Get it in your app store today.
Yeah, and which he's very proud of and thinks is much key to much of his success. And you know, with the Rafa Benitez team, they might not always play good football, but they're never going to be disorganized. Like they know where to stand, they know what to do, they're going to run hard. There's the old joke. I think it might have been Fernando Torres who once told a joke about he once scored a hat trick for Liverpool, and he came off and spoke to Rafa Benitez, and the first thing he did was like complain about something he had done wrong or something he could have done slightly differently. He's an incredibly methodical manager. And I think for a team like Everton, where, again, we've touched on it with United, Everton have to be the sum of more than the sum of their parts, because they can't afford to buy parts that are that great. And Rafa can get you there. And with Andros Townsend and Damari Gray, who they signed as well, yeah, they're not big names, but in Townsend you have a guy who's been a sort of hard-working, pretty fast, reliable, to an extent, wide player in the Premier League for many years now. He seems to be enjoying playing for a team that's not coached by Roy Hodgson, so he does get to attack a little bit. Damari Gray has been a revelation for him. I mean, there's talk that Damari Gray might get an England recall at some point. Maybe at the age of 25, Damari Gray will finally realize his potential. So I think this, for Everton, trying to find value in unexpected places in the market and having a manager who's like fully committed to trying to eke out these sort of marginal gains that you can, I think that works a lot better for them as a club than the sort of sexier and more sort of urbane and suave Ancelotti, James Rodriguez axis, put it that way.
Yeah, it does all feel like it makes more sense. And plus, again, they've got an owner willing to spend some sort of money, so that works.
Willing, but not allowed to, because they've maxed out their financial fair play, their spending caps. They've spent too much money.
Yeah. Well, later Saturday morning, the result that I probably Man United really wanted to mirror but could not in their tie against Everton was Chelsea's big win over Southampton 3-1. Now, Chelsea coming off kind of a weird week, a couple of losses both in the league and in Champions League at home at Stamford Bridge, end up putting up the points needed after giving up goals to Southampton, and things just kind of looking weird overall. We're in this kind of weird moment with Chelsea where they, you know, everything looks so good for Tuchel. Everything was flowing along. They were winning the Champions League. They started the season. They got Lukaku, and they looked really, really difficult to beat. And then there was a bit of a stutter here in the last week or so. And then when James Ward-Prowse gets the penalty kick to tie the game, you just started to wonder if this was the beginning of a low point in their biorhythms in the season.
Yeah, and we've mentioned this on the show before. I'm pretty big on Everton this season. I think Tuchel is a really smart manager.
You mean Chelsea?
Apologies. I'm very big on Chelsea this season. I think Tuchel is a very smart manager. I think he can be an abrasive manager, and I think he is someone who has had an issue at his previous clubs that he has sort of over time annoyed people and made himself difficult to work with.
I can't imagine.
Well, you saw this after the Juventus game when he spoke to the media and just sort of calmly rattled off a long list of things the team had done badly. Just no sort of impulse to defend them at all. And the press just say, oh, it's very strange. We were so bad at all these things. And he's very, very direct, very German, if you will. That's something that over time can be an issue, but I don't think we're there yet. What worried me a little bit, like you say, they'd had a few games where they just weren't that good, and I think it started. The game against Villa, they eventually won 3-0, but they weren't that convincing.
How much of this has to do with the missing Mason Mount and just kind of that lack of creative midfield that may be the one lacking area of depth for Tuchel?
Yeah, so I agree with this. So I think the sort of semis, again, against Villa, they weren't that convincing. Against Zenit in the Champions League, they weren't that good. Second half against Tottenham, they were good, but you don't with Tottenham these days, who knows? But then again, yeah, you lose to Man City, it can happen. You lose to Juventus, it can happen. But throughout these games, the thing that all sort of tied it together was that they weren't that convincing going forward. You know, they weren't creating a lot of chances. They looked a bit sort of, looked a bit iffy, I have to say. And as someone who's gone quite big on Chelsea early in the season, I was getting a little bit worried. Maybe I've been wrong about this. Maybe this won't just work itself out attacking-wise. And because of that, I think having a game against Southampton, when they where they won, I think was very, very important. But even before the red card, I think they were the better team here, and they were creating a good amount of chances. And I think it was always going to happen. Mason Mount's absence has been notable. And I think for a very simple sort of reason is he brings both energy and creativity, but he's also very good at making himself available. Like, he's one of those players who, like, if you're anywhere near Chelsea's midfield as a Chelsea player and you have the ball and you look up, who can I play it to? Mason Mount will be there. Like, he will be in space, ready to receive the ball. Just play it to me. He's always on the move. You don't see Mason Mount sort of hiding behind an opponent player waiting for something to happen very often. Always on the move, always making himself available. And I think especially against Juventus, they looked a little bit one-paced because they couldn't find openings and they couldn't find solutions. Now, against the packed Juventus defense, that isn't necessarily easy. But I think they lacked the sort of the initiative of Mason Mount there.
One of the things about Tuchel that I have found interesting in the last week or so is him diving into his toolbox and pulling out some guys from the bench that we haven't seen in a while. Hudson-Odoi, Loftus-Cheek, Barkley, a couple of these other guys that he's trying to use. I don't know how much success he's having with them, but he does appear to at least be trying to utilize some of these guys.
Yeah, and we mentioned Ole Gunnar Solskjaer rotating the United team. I thought this was actually pretty brave by Thomas Tuchel because they lost 1-0 to City, they lost 1-0 to Juventus. So you've lost two games, and you've also had two games in which you haven't scored a goal. You needed penalties to get past Aston Villa in the League Cup before that. So if you then don't get a result against Southampton, suddenly, you know, other coaches will tell you, if you lose three on the bounce in Chelsea, at Chelsea, suddenly, you know, alarm bells are ringing,
right,
regardless of what's going on. And Southampton, maybe not a great team, but they had got a draw against City, they had got a draw against Man United, so they're a team that can, you know, bother the famous people occasionally. So I think for him, going to the well and starting Loftus-Cheek, starting Hudson-Odoi as well, starting Trevor Chalobah in the back three, giving Chilwell a game at the expense of Marcus Alonso, has been very good for him so far. I thought that was pretty brave, actually, and it shows, I mean, maybe that's, in a way, I think that's Thomas Tuchel just, I don't really care that it would look bad if we didn't win this. Like, because he's like, he knows that losing to City is something that can happen. He knows that losing away to Juventus, come on, it's Juventus. So this sort of, oh no, three games without a win thing is just some sort of irrational nonsense that Tuchel would have no time for. But it's also maybe a signal of not just giving minutes to these guys, but also signaling that I trust you. You know, you can go out and play football. Like, Callum Hudson-Odoi is a really good footballer.
Well, the win.
Ruben Loftus Cheek, very sad story, all the injuries he's had, but he looked at one point like he could be a very, very good midfielder anyway, so, you know, it's good to see him get some minutes.
Well, the win 3-1 over Southampton does put Chelsea at the top of the table with 16 points, and real, as a quick answer, Lars, Ralf Hasenhüttl, is he a good coach?
I think he's a good coach, but I think what he's trying to do, I wonder if it's a good, like, his style of play, I wonder if it's a good fit for a lower half team in the Premier League.
Yeah.
Like, he's from the sort of, I mean, he's previously finished second in the Bundesliga with RB Leipzig and has that sort of Red Bull, we're going to press high, we're going to run a lot type of style. I think also with the way it works at Southampton, I don't think he's solely responsible for recruitment at that club. So it's a little bit to do with who they furnish him with in terms of who he's using. And Southampton did have a few they kept sort of going, they kept selling players for a lot of money, but then unearthing someone really good. Whereas I feel like the last few years, their recruitment has maybe been a little bit less strong. And you go through their sort of, their front four, you know, the two strikers and the two wingers here. It's Theo Walcott, who's still knocking around. It's Che Adams didn't start this one. It was actually Adam Armstrong, who signed from the Championship in the summer. Nathan Redmond and Nathan Tella. I mean, this is not a, you know, it's not a sort of front four that makes me think, wow, that's something you're really worried about coming up against.
So
I don't know. I think there's an issue of personnel there as well. And I think his style of play that he believes in, and we've seen work occasionally, I wonder if it's a little bit too ambitious for where they are in the world and the type of opponents they face on a weekly basis.
And then the game that ended Saturday, coming off a big win over Spurs and kind of reinflating expectations for Arteta, was Arsenal's trip to Brighton, which a lot of people said, okay, everybody hold on, you beat Spurs, that's cool, I know that's the North London derby, but Brighton is legit this season. Graham Potter's got something going on, and this is not going to be the cakewalk I think people typically expect for a team the size of Arsenal versus a club the size of Brighton. It was pouring rain. It was an absolute mess weather-wise. And here's the thing. I watched most of this game, and my takeaway was I think these teams appear to be largely equal in talent and in form, and I'm not quite sure if that says more about Brighton or more about Arsenal.
Well, if they're equal in talent, then the recruitment department at Arsenal have a lot to answer for, because they're certainly not equal in terms of the money that's been spent.
Well, okay, yes. Let me qualify what I'm saying in terms of talent. In the way they're performing, certainly on paper, none of these two teams are not equal in talent. But you understand where I'm coming from.
I know what I'm saying. Okay, all right. I know what you're saying. I think Brighton are very impressive in the sense that you can see Graham Potter is a very, very good coach. He's been given
some of the parts
there.
Thing. It's that whole thing we talk about, some
exactly,
of the parts, right?
Exactly right. And he's been given time to work. I mean, it wasn't results-wise amazing last year, but their owner is a guy who made his money in the gambling industry. So I think he is someone who knows how to look at underlying numbers and expected goals and this sort of thing, and spot that actually this is a team that's actually doing a lot of things right, and we don't need to change manager. And just because the results weren't quite what we were hoping for. And they look, again, you see a team where everyone clearly knows what their job is. You know, this is a very well-coached team. It's very good structure off the ball. You can see everyone knows that there are patterns there. You can see I'm using a lot of words just to say they're a very well-coached team.
They are. And here's the thing. We said at the end of last season, if they just finished some of the opportunities, if they could just figure out how to, as Tommy Smith says, put the old ball in the onion bag, things would turn for them. And they started to do that this season. Now, in this particular game, it suddenly started to feel a lot like Brighton last year, because they had a lot of opportunities. They were blowing balls over the top, missing some easier opportunities. I hope that's not a trend for Graham Potter's team. But that, to me, has been the big difference this year, is they've actually just started finishing.
Yeah, it is a conundrum for them, because in someone like Neil Mopai, their striker, their main guy up front, there are a lot of strikers in the world who are probably better finishers than Neil Mopai and will score more goals across the season. But it's hard to find someone who will put in as much of a work off the ball and pressing and winning the ball back as Neil Mopai does, and will also score you some extra goals. So you could, I mean, in the last couple of years, he's got 10 the year before last. He's got just 8 last year. 4 so far, so he's much, much improved finishing for Neil Mopai. You could replace him with someone who has a better goal-scoring record and someone who's technically a better finisher, but will you get someone who'll put in the amount of work off the ball as he does? And that is key to their whole system. I think they're a very impressive outfit, and I think the way, you know, they had Chris Hughton as a manager who was very well regarded, but he was quite defensive, quite reactive. He kept them up. They decided to move on from him anyway and hire Graham Potter. And a lot of people said, you know, oh no, you know, you're going to regret that. You know, you're trying to play more fancy football. That's not going to end well. But I think that was a very brave move by the club, and it's worked out really well for them.
Picking up Lallana was a big deal for them, and has worked out well for them. And you do get the sense that if they can just keep away from the injury bug, they've got the right, just enough, a number of guys that they can give a lot of people trouble over the course of the season and end up pushing potentially for a European spot, I think.
Yeah, I think that's possible. I still worry if goal scoring might over time still be an issue.
Sure.
I think
yesterday
there
was a
like,
good example.
I would feel more comfortable in their sort of solid top half credentials if they had just one player who you knew was going to get them 15 to 20 goals during the season and who would score goals reliably. If you're talking about their recruitment, Marco Correa, the Spanish left wing back, is a very clever pickup. He's a former La Masia, former Barcelona product, who was a very attack-minded left back when he came up in the Barcelona system, who's then been out playing first for Eibar and then for Getafe, two sort of really... well, Eibar is a tiny club in the Basque Country, and Getafe is kind of known as kind of the Burnley of Spain, like the sort of the S-houses of Spain.
Isn't Eibar the Spanish club who has the stadium in the middle of mountains that I really want to go see a game at somewhere?
Yes, and apartment blocks looking down on the thing.
Yes, it looks amazing. Their
capacity is actually 8,000. Yeah. And they were in La Liga, incredibly. But basically, he's been out on loan and spent time away from Barcelona at players where you can't just come with your fancy La Masia ways. Like, you're gonna have to work hard for your food. So he's learned how to work and has been playing as a left winger, but in a very defensive setup. So if you move him in and play him as a left wing back, he seems to have slotted in just effortlessly. You know, has the engine to get up and down, has the aggression to help with the high press they play occasionally. I think he's a very clever pickup, and I expect him to go to a much bigger club than Brighton. So they're a clever recruitment department there. Still concerned about them getting enough goals.
All right. Now, speaking of getting enough goals, in seven games, Arsenal now has scored only 5 goals, which is a low number for them dating back way, way back. Got a big win over Spurs. This is going to be a disappointing result for a lot of people in many ways, but I continue to believe that if you've got a midfield that includes, or at least an attacking end that has Saka and Odegaard and Partey and Smith Rowe, you got to be just a complete dead brain dummy not to figure out how to make that work.
Yeah, no, absolutely. But the contrasts from last weekend and this weekend is absolutely huge. I mean, they played against a Tottenham team that appeared to have no midfield. I mean, it was remarkable. They had an interesting analysis on this on Sky Sports over here, where Jamie Carragher, former Liverpool defender, sort of picked some stills and picked some movements from the first half between Tottenham and Arsenal, where it seemed, and we can't read their minds, so we don't know, but it seemed as if Nuno Espirito Santo had basically told Dele Alli and Tanguy Ndombele to station themselves really high and fight for second balls or something, right? Because you basically had very high up the field Dele Alli and Tanguy Ndombele, and then a massive hole, and then Pierre-Emile Højbjerg in the back four. And there was just this huge gap in the middle, which, like, normal, you know, midfielders wouldn't just leave. Like, a normal midfielder doesn't just go, well, there's a huge gap here. There's just no one in the entire middle of the park. I'm sure that's fine. I'll just go stand over here. I mean, you don't really do that unless you've been specifically told to. So there's some tactical shenanigans going on there. But it did mean that whenever Arsenal regained the ball in that first half, like Carragher said, there's less space on the moon than in the sort of Tottenham midfield there. It was really strange. And Ødegaard and Saka and Smith Rowe, when they came on these counter-attacking opportunities, suddenly there was just no one there, and they could just run in peace. And obviously that made them look very good, and I think they are very good players. But the contrast between that and playing against the Brighton side that is very well organized, and players know exactly where they're meant to stand, and they certainly don't leave a massive hole for no reason in the middle of the park. It was a big contrast, and it was maybe a bit of a wake-up call for some who may have gone overboard last Sunday. I saw one former Arsenal player basically said that that Arteta can be the next Arsene Wenger, and I thought, mate, like, you can maybe settle down a little bit.
Well, it certainly...
Gael Clichy, by the way. I got to name and shame him. It was Gael Clichy.
It puts a fine point on the whole thing about, hey, all right, you beat Spurs, but this Brighton thing's going to be a much bigger test, and it definitely turned out to be. So 0-0. Here's the thing. Think about this. Brighton sits in sixth place, tied with that group of teams. They're in sixth, but tied essentially with a bunch of teams in third with 14 points. And Arsenal all the way down below the Mendoza line in 11th with 10 points. And I don't think after seven games many people would have predicted that at the beginning of the season. Now, you've talked a lot about Spurs and their game today. Look, I don't know how to measure out what is going on with this team. You and I and Andy haven't spent a lot of time talking about Tottenham, but I do think at the beginning of the season, when you began to think about all of the off the field wonkiness that was going on with this club, the Harry Kane situation, just the situation with the manager where they sorted through, was there ever an official count of how many managers they actually talked to before they finally ended up with Nuno? Was it 7?
No,
eight?
I mean, that's never going to be made public, but the general feeling was that Nuno was some 6th or 7th choice, I think.
But that's weird, right?
And intriguingly, he was initially rejected as a candidate.
But
before a few weeks later, they sort of doubled back. Oh, maybe, yeah.
But in any business, if you get to the point where you're at the 6th person you want to hire for a position in leadership like that, things have gone wrong, and so I don't think everybody's expectations for this season, especially because I think most people assumed Harry Kane was going to be sold off, but here we are. They're not playing well. They look really weird in Nuno's system. This whole thing that he used to do with Wolves looked really good on a team like Wolves, but doesn't look good when Tottenham's wearing it. And I know they won today against Aston Villa, and there were bits and pieces of times where they flowed really nicely and some of the execution was really good, but I still am not sold that this thing is going to end well by the end of the season.
Yeah, so the cheap throwaway line I've been using is that we kind of thought Nuno would try to turn Tottenham into Wolves with better forwards, but so far it looks like he's turning them into Wolves with worse defenders, which is not where you want to be.
No, good Lord.
I still would say, and again, this is me being slightly boring, I still think it's worth to wait and see a little bit. Just for the fact that, like you said, they had the Harry Kane circus going into the season that will have been a distraction. They had some injuries. You've had the sort of the Dubrovnik 3, as I saw them referred to as, the South American players who desperately wanted to play for their countries, and I fully respect them for that, but because of the way quarantine rules work, it meant that they had to quarantine before they could play again coming back, and they spent 10 days in Croatia because, I don't know, COVID rules are strange. But it also meant, it meant he couldn't use them and couldn't work with them on the training ground, and again, like I said, injuries. So basically, there's always been something going on that's meant Nuno hasn't had a lot of time to work with this team on the training ground. We haven't had a lot of games where we've seen what we think is their strongest 11. So I'm still a little... I mean, this might be very generous of me after sort of 6-7 games in the league and even more in the cups and stuff to still be on the wait and see with this. But I still think this team, we don't really know what the coach wants it to look like. We know for sure that they cannot possibly look like they did in the first half against Arsenal again, because that was one of the worst things we've ever seen. They were also very, very bad against Crystal Palace. I mean, that's some of the worst we've seen from this team in recent years. And there's stuff like, I don't know, I haven't seen updated stats after today, but after the Arsenal game, there was something like the team that had run the least in the league, which is like, there's no real excuse for that. And that worries me a little bit. And they were the team that had created the fewest shots per game in face.
Which is definitely weird considering you've got, Son and Kane and all these talented players that were so good under Pochettino. Just the whole thing looks very different. And the fact that this team, with essentially the same lot of players, looks so different under three different coaches is weird to me.
Well, I think what you have to bear in mind is they are a different team now than they were in the Pochettino. Important players from that group have moved on, and the players who are here now are a little bit older.
Eriksen?
And they don't maybe have...
Who else?
Eriksen, Dembele in midfield was very important in the Pochettino.
Okay.
Victor Wanyama was quite important for a while in the Pochettino while he still had legs. The defenders, Alderweireld and Vertonghen, were very important in the Pochettino.
Right.
Danny Rose and Kit Trippier on each wing back. I mean, this is a very changed team from when they were good on the Pochettino. And I still think with this, we have to give it a little bit more time to because there have been a lot of interruptions and complications. And in the end of the day, you know what? It hasn't been good. They haven't played well, but they've kind of gotten away with it. They've got 12 points. They're just 4 points behind Chelsea, which all sounds right. completely absurd. But that's kind of where we are.
So
they're very much a work in progress. They have been really bad, but they picked up enough points that it's not a crisis yet.
All right, so they're 2 points ahead of Villa, who they beat today 2-1, got a goal at the end of the game. Question, you take Spurs fans and you take Villa fans. Are those two groups of fans that have similar expectations or very different expectations?
That's such an interesting question. I keep thinking I'm talking too much and this is dragging on a bit, but then you're asking me questions that I can talk for, talk about for an hour. I think you've hit upon a key point to do with Tottenham here, which is where should the expectations be for this team? And this is because under the sort of Pochettino era, Tottenham fans got kind of used to being a regular fixture in the top four and sort of looking like they might actually have a title push at some point. And you know, making a Champions League final and this new stadium was built and there was a real sort of feeling that we've moved on now from this sort of mid-table existence that they'd had for a very, very long time. But they're still, like, in terms of turnover, they're still the sixth strongest team in the league financially. And we know the finances dictate a lot in European football. They're still a way back behind some of the stronger teams money-wise. And I think it's worth remembering, I mean, those three seasons when they finished third, second, and third, that was only, I think, the second time in the club's entire existence that they'd finished above third three seasons in a row.
Right.
So I mean, they don't have a trophy to show for it, but it's a case to be made that this was, you know, one of the best, most prolonged, successful periods in Tottenham's history. And I think a lot of people, because that's human nature, we kind of got used to them being up there and now they want more, are expecting them to kick on. Whereas the reality is they were maybe overperforming a little bit in those years because Harry Kane was playing unbelievably well, unsustainably well, possibly, because Pochettino was sort of squeezing things out of these players that they might not be able to replicate. And maybe Spurs sort of dropping down to 6th, 7th, maybe that is more the natural order of things. Now, you'll struggle to find Tottenham fans who agree with that. I think their expectation is they see themselves as part of the top 6 and a team that should be top 4. But, you know, I think if your turnover is the 6th biggest in the league and you pay the 6th biggest if you have the 6th biggest wage budget, then 6th is kind of par.
All right, Spurs 2, Aston Villa 1. Big win for the Spurs and some frustration for Villa fans who probably have been hoping. I don't know. Maybe they haven't been hoping for more. Maybe not. All right, we have been going on a bit here. We have drug out a little bit. That's okay because it's
my
all.
Apologies.
No, don't apologize. It's good content. But we'll do the rest of this a little bit more snappily, and I won't ask you such smart questions. How about that? That's my
dumb questions only.
Dumb questions only from Peter for Lars. Now the game that I wish I had watched, and I need to go back and watch because I had noticed at the 40th minute it was 2-0 Leicester and thought, oh, that's over. Turned out to be quite a game. Crystal Palace at Selhurst Park come back and end up tying that game 2-2. And I mentioned earlier, there's been a lot of great surprises in this Premier League season. We'll talk about Brentford here in a little bit. We've talked about some other surprises like Everton. But is Patrick Vieira as a successful or how well he's done at Palace to date, is that not the biggest surprise so far of this Premier League season?
Well, I'm going to have to say that because I didn't think it would go well. I mean, I had them. We spoke about them a bit before the season.
Yeah.
I had them as my, I hope they do well, but I don't think they'll do well. That was my sort of outlook on them because they made some really brave moves in the summer. There was a real sort of generational shift where a lot of the sort of old guard from Roy Hodgson, their contracts expired. You know, they had to bring in a lot of new players. They had to bring in a new coach. And they went quite young. They signed quite a lot of young players and they signed a pretty untested coach, I think you have to say, in Patrick Vieira.
Sure.
These are really brave moves.
And, by the way, we weren't super impressed by Patrick over here in Major League Soccer in his short time here.
No. And I don't think they were in France either. So it's one of those former player of legendary player status who hasn't quite done it as a coach gets great coaching job stories, and they tend not to end very well. So I was a little bit concerned. So far, it's gone well, and I think there is a sort of youthfulness to this team that we haven't really seen before. And of all the people we spoke about that they signed, we didn't speak about Conor Gallagher a lot. And bringing in Conor Gallagher on loan from Chelsea, he's a young attacking midfielder who was at West Bromwich last season. He's looked very, very exciting in the sense that he's a guy who can run absolutely all day, very, very energetic, but has a little bit of sort of a little bit of flair to him and a little bit of invention. And he's been really good for them.
All right. Now, here's where we talk about the differences in expectations, because as we praise Palace and Vieira, they've actually only won one game this season, drawn four, and they sit in 14th with 7 points. The team they tied today, Leicester, who have a completely different set of expectations, actually only sits 1 point ahead of them in 13th place with 8 points. And the whole Brendan Rodgers and what's going to happen to Leicester this season story is its own fascinating thing. And as I said, a very, very different set of expectations going the other direction.
Yeah, now Brendan Rodgers has enough credit in the bank that I think cataclysmically bad things will have to happen for him to come under threat at Leicester. But this isn't good. Now, I think it has a little bit to do with injuries, and that's a little bit of a cop-out when we're talking about this and we want to like have deep discussions about what's going wrong on the field and such. I think losing Wesley Fofana, the young defender, to a bad injury was really bad for them because it was late in the window and they had to sort of scramble to find a new defender. Ended up signing Yannick Vestergaard, who we like, generally speaking, but he's mm-hmm. quite a big, slow guy and I think maybe hasn't quite integrated into Leicester's system that well. They were missing Ndidi from midfield, maybe the best sort of... the best ball-winning midfielder not named N'Golo Kante in the league. I would argue Ndidi is a very, very good player. He wasn't there for them. And they've been really struggling defensively so far. And I think at least Jamie Vardy has started scoring again, because that was also a concern earlier in the season when they had a couple of bad results and Jamie Vardy looked like he maybe wasn't quite Jamie Vardy anymore. And that would be bad. And that's something that we know... at some point it's going to have to happen. Like, he's 34. The decline of Jamie Vardy will have to happen sometime. But he's now scoring goals again, which is very important for them. But I think, really, it's the defensive side of it that's been the problem for them so far.
Okay, so a name has popped up in a club that I am completely unfamiliar with. He scored not once, but twice yesterday for Wolves. Hwang Hee Chan.
Yes.
Where did this cat come from? He actually looks like a little bit of a player.
He is South Korean. He's a South Korean forward who's been through the Red Bull system. He came to Europe and played for RB Salzburg in the Austrian league for many years.
Right.
And then was, as is often the case, when someone plays well for RB Salzburg, they're moved on to RB Leipzig. The teams, of course, have energy drink related ownership. But. But a few years back, when they both qualified for European competitions, there was an investigation done by UEFA to see if there might be a conflict of interest here. And they were satisfied that they were not owned by the same people, which I think is an extraordinary decision for UEFA to reach.
Shocker.
But no, Red Bull Salzburg and Red Bull Leipzig, not connected in a way that's problematic. So here we go. There seems to be a mysterious number of players that seamlessly move from one of those clubs to the other. But there we go.
Well, he's not Portuguese, and he's playing at Wolverhampton. And
That's a very unusual state of affairs, isn't it? So yeah, he was part of the fizzy drink empire, and as you'd expect from an attacking player from that footballing school, I guess you can almost call it, he's very, very hardworking, very committed. The interesting thing is that he has a reputation for being really hardworking, really, you know, good mentality, good guy, but maybe not the best finisher in the world. And I think he ended up with no goals for Leipzig last season, which is not ideal. And
well, he's already way ahead of himself because he scored twice yesterday.
He got a reasonable number of minutes for them as well. So that was unfortunate for him in the Bundesliga. Like, he came off the bench a lot, if we're being honest. But yeah, didn't quite do it at RB Leipzig. But already two very, very good finishes here, and someone who will bring a bit of even more pace and movement to what's already quite a pacey forward line for Wolves.
Well, certainly a win for Wolves that they needed. They now are up to 12th and 9th. Newcastle, oh, good Lord, still have yet to win a game, sitting below the relegation zone in 19th with only 3 points. Yipes, that's not good for... Steve Bruce's men at this point. Maybe, you know, they always seem to turn it around. Now, the other game today that really caught everybody's eye And this is clearly one of those games that provides evidence that sometimes when clubs finally make their way to Europe, that ends up becoming a bit of a problem, more of an issue than a benefit. And it does feel that way with West Ham, because after playing well in Europe in midweek, they had to turn around and play an early game on an early-ish game on Saturday. Now it was home, but here we go. We start to see the European effect as the Brentford Bees do it again. Holy cow, this has got to be the story of the year. On a very late free kick that they win in injury time, Fabianski punches the free kick out, and Wiese just nicely knocks it in to win the game 2-1, Brentford at the London Stadium over West Ham.
Yeah, West Ham stung by the bees. Instead, the Hammers, instead of swatting... Instead of swatting the bees,
you said
the mighty
stung
Hammers...
By the,
yeah, they were stung by the bees.
You're a professional journalist,
you know what,
Lars.
You know what?
You're
so
better
bad,
than
it's
that,
good.
Lars.
It's fine. It's okay. That's my new strategy. If I say something that's really bad, just say, don't worry.
Don't worry.
It's okay.
It's
it works.
Okay.
Let's move on.
Just move
Let's
on.
Move on.
Okay.
Yeah, I agree. I think West Ham is one of those teams. They don't have a very deep squad. Whether that is because the owners don't want to invest or whether David Moyes likes it that way, I couldn't actually tell you, because actually the owners, having been criticized heavily for a period for not spending, they then went off and spent quite a bit. So you never really know how much money they're willing to commit. And I do, you know, knowing the history of David Moyes, he doesn't like to rotate too much. He likes having his guys. Now, that can be a challenge when you're combining...
midweek combining and...
With the midweek and the thing. So, yeah, unfortunate. But I kind of feel like the big story here is Brentford, who have just really been completely fearless. I think that's the thing that's really eye-catching with them. You know, they've had this is a very small club. It's not that long ago they were in the third tier. It's actually not that long ago they were down in the fourth tier in the pyramid here in England. And they've built their way to the top through being very canny in the transfer market, through making money off of their players. It's complete moneyball stuff here, using a lot of statistics to find value. And they've built a reputation in the Championship as being a very sort of front foot, high press, you know, team that likes to play football. And I guess you're kind of always assuming if they get promoted, they're gonna have to ease up a little bit on that, because you're gonna get punished in the Premier League if you play like that. And they haven't really done that. They've gone forth and they're not afraid to attack the teams they come up against, and really, three wins in the first seven, I don't think a lot of people were expecting from
them.
So that's this huge positive. It's great to see.
Yeah, and I mean, here we go. I'm sure Brentford was one of the clubs that all of us, I think, said were going down. I think in our predictions, Andy's got this written down, and he's not here.
Someone's going to... I had all the newly promoteds to go back down.
Oh, that's right. That was your bit at the beginning of the season.
But I did say that out of the three, if one's going to spring a surprise, I think it's Brentford. I'm pretty sure. I at least said that elsewhere.
Well, okay, so here's the question.
But that's just Scandinavian bias. They have a lot of Scandinavians, so I have to obviously support them.
All right, so this is where your expertise will come in handy, because this is the piece that I find most interesting out of this, which is you've got a team like Brentford, who hasn't ever played in the Premiership, come up and at least initially are exceeding expectations greatly. On the other hand, you've got Watford and Norwich, two teams that have been up and down into the Premiership and back down to the Championship multiple times individually, much less in between them. And those two teams are fumbling about, and Norwich in particular, we'll talk about in a second. What is the difference, from your perspective, between what Brentford has done well and what the Watfords and Norwiches of the world do wrong?
So with Norwich... The interesting thing is that they were really, really good last year in the Championship. Like, they didn't just get promoted. They were really convincing. And the coach of Luton Town, Nathan Jones, called them the Manchester City of the Championship, which sounds silly now, of course, when they're being... But it meant because their possession game was so good. You know, they had really sort of clearly defined possession game. But I wonder if they just have a game model that doesn't work as well against much stronger opponents. I mean, it might be one of those. And it's also worth mentioning their best creative player, Emiliano Buendia, of course, 15 goals and 16 assists last year, is at Aston Villa now.
And by the way, can't get a start there either. And that's a whole other thing we didn't talk about.
Not yet. Whereas the sort of defensive midfielder who kind of held it all together in midfield is named Oliver Skip, has now been given a chance at Tottenham. It's actually looking quite good for them. So they lost their two most important midfielders when they went up. They have recruited, and they've signed the very good Norwegian midfielder, Mathias Norman. So some Nordic bias, obviously, I have from me.
Just some.
But I think he is very good. He was made their player of the month in spite of having played 130 minutes, I think, during the month, which tells you something about how highly regarded he is. And if you just search for his name on social media, I think you'll find the Norwich fans are impressed. So he's very good. But you're right, they're just a little bit too easy to play against. Teemu Pukki, God bless him. It's not really. He's a very clever finisher, and his movement's very good. But he's not that fast. He's not that strong. He needs players to create chances for him, and not that many chances are being created. They're just a little bit easy to play against.
Now, here's the great question: the coach for Norwich last week, after losing that game, pointed out that he told the media, I think I'm saying this correctly, tell me if I'm wrong, Lars. Mm. He said something along the lines of, hey, look, it didn't work out. It's going to be okay. Everybody in the dressing room sees this pointed in the right direction. And by the way, guys, we're only 3 points off our plan.
Yeah.
Now, considering they were on 0 points,
yeah,
my question is, after getting a point today in a rather snoozy draw against Burnley at Burnley, which is actually quite an achievement for Norwich to do, by the way, are the Canaries 2 points off the plan now, or are they 5 points off the plan? That's my big question.
So if you're the coach of Norwich and the fixture computer throws up Liverpool at home, Manchester City away, Leicester at home, Arsenal away in your first 4 games, and then Watford, okay, but then Everton away. Like, you know that's probably not going to end well for you. You know you're most likely going to lose the first 4 games. And I don't think there's necessarily anything wrong with being honest about that with your players, just to prepare them and try to think so that morale doesn't go through the floor when they lose their first 4 games, because that's just the reality of being newly promoted in this league. Some might argue that the Brentford coach probably didn't say that before they played Arsenal in the opening game of the season. Maybe there's a sort of element of defeatism there. But, I think the fixture list has been very tough on them. But I think at home to Watford, they will have expected to win. And they will have certainly been expected to win something away to Burnley. And this is where the fixtures, it does matter the order in which these games come along. Because if you get drawn against these really tough opponents and everyone starts to feel bad about what's going on, even if they're not bad defeats on paper, not really, it can really have a negative effect on morale and belief and this sort of thing, and it's tricky for them. Now coming up, of course, Brighton next week, is not easy, and then away to Chelsea.
Yeah, Norwich got hammered bad on the schedule, and my only hope is if they could somehow struggle through and get just some points before it starts to lighten up, that would be great. Especially, I think their Christmas schedule actually lessens up quite a bit. Now, there's a lot of games in a small window, but it's not big six opponents and things like that.
It's going to have to, because you're running out of
running out of big clubs.
You've played them all.
And of course, Sean Dyche and Burnley will not be pleased that they could not get the 3 points against lowly Norwich at this point of the season.
I wonder if this is the year
that he finally gets the boot.
Maybe this is the year. No, when they finally go down.
Oh, yeah, they are in 18th. Here's the deal: they're only 2 points ahead of Norwich, right?
It's the sort of Burnley dark magic that shouldn't work, but kind of works year in and year out. And they're not a great team on paper, and you watch them a lot of games, you think, this is just terrible. But they always have a spell in the air when they win enough games to ultimately keep them up. I mean, it's going to happen again. They're going to have another sort of spell of a few months where they play well, win some games. People start talking about how Sean Dyche should be in charge of, I don't know, Everton or something. And then they'll go back to losing every time. It'll be enough for them to stay up, I guess.
Okay, and then we round it out with a conversation of the last game of the weekend that we have yet to discuss, and it comes with two conversations that I think we need to have, and I think we'll start off with the, well, first off, the result. Leeds at home at Elland Road end up getting a 1-0 win over Watford. Llorente with a goal in the 18th minute. And then we wake up this morning to find out that, like clockwork, like the sunrise, Watford has fired their manager. Although the tweet they put out said has left the club, like he voluntarily just left and never came back or something. He is out. Have they announced a replacement for him yet?
Word is it's going to be Claudio Ranieri. It's not been made public yet, I believe, but it looks like it's Claudio Ranieri coming back.
Why would Claudio do that to himself?
Well, I mean, Watford, it's close to London. The training ground is close to Heathrow, I think, so you can get
Yeah, but he'll get fired in 8 months.
No, but then you take the money and run, right?
Okay.
He's out of work at the moment. I think he has a lovely house in London, and I'm pretty sure the Watford training ground is pretty close to Heathrow, so it's good if you want to do a bit of jet setting between sessions.
I don't understand Watford.
It's a great job to get. And you know what? If you get fired, then so what? Everyone gets fired from Watford. Who cares?
Wow, it's crazy. It's the most amazing story, I think, to watch, because inevitably, I mean, look, they're sitting in 15th place. They've got 7 points. Sure, they lost to Leeds, but a lot of teams are going to lose to at Elland Road this year. It just seemed like weird timing to fire the guy, especially after getting them back up into the Premiership.
Yeah, maybe it does. But, you know, this is what the owners do. The Pozzo family, who own Watford, who also own Udinese in Serie A, they have a very sort of, you know, if it's not working, we'll change the coach approach to these things. Mm. And it's easy to make fun of them because it's not most people's idea of how a football club should be run. But actually, if you look at the results over the years with Watford, you know, they've done pretty well. And I think, you know, we had this discussion when they got relegated. They went down alongside Bournemouth, and everyone were saying, well, you know, of course they keep firing their coaches, so of course they get relegated. You know, they're crazy people, these owners. Whereas when Bournemouth got relegated, it was like, oh, it's very unlucky for Eddie Howe. You know, they're a good club. You know, they do things the right way. They got promoted the same year. Bournemouth spent considerably more money than Watford on both transfer fees and wages. Bournemouth's average league position over four seasons was 12th. Watford's average league finish was 13th. Yeah. They had basically the same results. So there are more ways to skin a cat here. And I think Watford is a pretty small club. They don't put a lot of money into the club because I don't think they're those kinds of owners. And yeah, they have a high turnover of managers. In some periods, they've had a high turnover of players, but it's a model that's worked pretty well for them.
Well, I am rooting quietly for Watford to do the trick that a lot of clubs have done of late, which is hire a club legend, and Troy Deeney doesn't seem to be doing anything right now, so maybe he should be the manager.
Is he playing for somebody? He's gone to Birmingham, I believe.
Oh, that's right. That's his old club he went back to. Yeah.
I should double check that.
Well, he's got time on his hands. He could do both, couldn't he?
I should correct myself. I mean, Watford did used to train right next to Heathrow, but they've moved now. They're closer to where Arsenal train, which is further from Heathrow.
All right.
But you're still in London, so that's good. I think Ranieri suits this squad quite a bit, because what Watford has, this is not a great squad, and we said this before the season, in terms of quality, I think it's one of the three worst squads in the league. So if they get relegated, you know, not completely unexpected. But if you look at what they have, they have some really fast attackers there in Ismaïla Assar, in Emmanuel Dennis, in Josh King. Now, what we know Ranieri can do, he's a back-to-basics guy. He'll probably set them up in a 4-4-2 like he always does. He'll make sure everyone knows where to stand. He's very methodical in that way. They're not going to be exciting, but I think there's a chance Ranieri could fix their defense, and then they have quick forwards who can unsettle enough defenses that maybe they have a chance of staying up.
All right, well, you're noted. As a chance to stay up, Lars Sivertsen has noted that Watford under Claudio Ranieri has a chance to stay up. Now, the other last conversation to have is the question about Leeds United and our hero, Andy and I's favorite coach in the world, Bielsa, and his ongoing situation at Leeds. Now, they did win today. It was their first win of the season. Not today, I guess it was yesterday, actually, sorry. And they do sit in lowly 16th place with only 6 points, which, by the way, is a point behind aforementioned Watford.
Yes.
Here's the thing. Do we expect even if they have a good season, does anybody expect Bielsa to stay any more than this particular season? Hold on before you answer that question. And if things continue to go sour, would Victor Orta and the ownership get rid of Bielsa, or would Bielsa, because in a very Bielsa way, honorably choose to leave on his own accord in the middle of the night without telling anybody? And no matter what the result of those two things are, who is likely to take this team over, considering the shape and form and style that it's in today?
So, first question is very difficult. The latter questions are easier. So, first question is, it's a fool's game to try to predict what Bielsa is going to do when it comes to these things. I think they'll turn it around. I know they've had some injuries that have hurt them. They've had some defensive injuries that have been a big problem for them. Patrick Bamford's missed a few games. You know, I think people are very quick to want to write them off because all the while they've been playing here. I mean, you and I like them a lot, but the sort of football establishment in England are like, you're doing this all the wrong way. Like, this is not how you're meant to play football. So the second it goes wrong results wise, everyone's like, you're not doing it sensibly. Of course it's all going wrong. So I think people are quite keen for them to fail. But I think it's too early to really pull the sort of emergency ripcord here. I mean, but with regards to how you would replace him, I think that's actually quite easy because there are legions of managers out there who are inspired by Bielsa in some way and have taken aboard like key parts of his methodology, but maybe shaped it into a little bit more normal,
something less risky, right?
Yeah, exactly. There are a lot of like Bielsa disciples out there who would want to manage a team like Leeds in the Premier League. So I don't think that's actually very hard how you can find someone who can continue to build on the work they've done under Bielsa.
All right, but maybe
make little tweaks.
Weird question. By and large, do Leeds fans in Leeds really like and enjoy how Leeds plays under Bielsa? I know they've loved the results, and I love the fact that, you know, they've done what they've done. But I have no investment in Leeds, but I love watching them play for all the reasons that we talk about. It's just wheels off. It's crazy. Like, they try things no matter how risky or dangerous it is. They push. They leave space. But I do wonder, if I was an invested Leeds fan, at some point, this has to become taxing on your existence in terms of fanship, right?
So, I mean, all fan bases have this, but Leeds in particular have a very strong sort of us against the world type of thing. You know, they're historically a club that's been quite unpopular with the public in general. You know, when they were successful many, many decades ago, they were known as a particularly dirty team. Hmm. So they won a lot
dirty
of games.
Leeds. Very,
yes, exactly right. And because of that, this whole idea that no one likes us, and the idea of being antagonistic towards everyone is a pretty solidly, you know, rooted thing in the Leeds fan base, even more so than with fans of other clubs, because this is quite a universal thing, but it's very strong with Leeds. And I think partially because of that, they've really embraced it. And they've really, you know, look at the football we get to watch. And you see people talk about, like, it's not just that they've been back in the Premier League, but they've gone back playing some of the best football in the club's history, really, in terms of entertainment. And that's something they're very proud of. And in true football supporter fashion, they get pretty defensive about it on the internet if people question the merits. And rightly so, I think. You know, it's an extraordinary ride they've been on. They're not a team who have, you know, had... They have spent money after being promoted, yes, but they haven't had, like, millions pumped into them. Bielsa took over a mid-table championship team and without making a lot of changes in personnel, had them promoted. It's an extraordinary achievement, playing some of the best football we've ever seen.
And they played really well last year and ended up in a mid-table position and...
Yeah, and now there might be an element of teams... And I kind of hate this phrase, but because it's not like teams don't do analysis,
right.
But it might be an element of teams working them out a little bit. Like, everyone's played them twice now. A lot of players know, okay, so this is what you're doing. And there are counters to that. That might be a threat, especially that sort of very strange man-marking thing they do off the ball.
Yeah.
Much more man-marking than zonal marking. Like there are ways of gaming that system when you know it's coming and when you've done it a few times. So I think it's going to be an interesting thing to track going forward. But I think it's way too early to talk about this going completely wrong.
Yeah, I don't think any of us were... I think all of us were expecting them to kind of fall off the boil a little bit this season. The way the season has started so far, I think it's probably... I mean, they have a goal differential of -7 right now.
What?
That's not good.
You know, it's true. But it can happen when you play the way Leeds do. When it goes wrong, it can go very wrong. I think it's more about they haven't been... there's a 5-1 loss to Man United, and they lost 3-0 to Liverpool, and you know, this sort of thing can happen. I think it's more about when you play that in such an attacking manner, it's very important that you do finish your chances, because if you don't, it can get really ugly.
All right, so as we go into this particular international break, Chelsea on top with 16 points, Liverpool in second with 15, and then City, United, Everton, and Brighton, yes, Brighton, are in third with 14 points. And then there are the Brentford Bees and Spurs tied with 12, and then West Ham and Aston Villa round out the top 10 with 11 and 10 points, respectively. It's been an interesting season so far. There have been some nice surprises, and lo and behold, we had a big tilt game today, and it turned out to pay off and entertain, even though it ended up in a draw. I think so far, so good this season.
Yeah, it's been a lot of fun, and it's been a lot of fun talking about it.
Yes.
And I sense we're approaching the end of this very long recording, so I'd like to say thank you to all the listeners for hanging out with us. I've enjoyed your company.
Is there something else, Lars, you want to discuss and just kind of mull about? We've mowed through all the games. You've pontificated about all of this insight and knowledge that you have about the Premier League for us. Would you like to talk about Eskimo pies or... fish and chip food? You like Eskimo pie as a dessert here in the United States.
I'm obviously very worried about the state of FC Dallas.
Lars.
We're having such a good time, and I have to bring it down by sort of, you know. Okay, we're currently 3 points ahead of Austin, which feels like not enough points ahead of Austin.
Oh, look, here's the thing. The entire state of Texas currently...
Like Salt Bay, sprinkling salt in the open wounds. Yeah.
Yeah. The entire state of Texas, the great nation of Texas, sucks at soccer at the moment. Dallas is only barely the best team of the three by a smidge. I don't know if it'll end that way at all. Not that anybody cares at the end of the day, but we do hope for another bright day in Dallas soccer next season. We'll all just kind of give it up and hope that next year's better, Lars. I'm going to have to find out who your childhood club back in Norway is or was so that I can pick out their foibles and poke on you about Tromsø.
It's harder to find a stream for the Norwegian second tier, my friend.
Oh, the second tier, huh?
Oh, yes. Just promoted from the third tier last year, so we're up now in the second tier. It's excellent. Very exciting.
What team is this?
We used to be Brina.
Lars, I'm from Texas. I don't have an idea of what you just said. What's the name of the club?
Brine. Brine.
Okay.
Well, every time I Google them, my English Google thinks I'm trying to find out more about Gabriel Byrne, which is not what I'm after at all.
Or Brill Cream.
No, they used to be sort of perennial second tier, you know, club who then fell on hard times and had to dump down in the third tier for a few years, and that was quite depressing. They won the cup the year I was born. They've been in an A Cup final in my lifetime.
Club legend? Is there a club legend anybody that listens to this pod may know by name?
So I would say probably Alfie Haaland would be our big name. But I guess now it's Erling Haaland, who did just about play for us at the beginning of his career.
That would be notable, yes. But did he actually play for Brenna?
He did. He played a few games. Didn't actually score because this was when he was very young and hadn't grown into himself just yet. But Erling Haaland has played for my team.
All right.
And he was part of the sort of youth set there.
All right. Last thing before we go. When can Andy and I expect the photograph of you doing something cliche or standing next to something cliche in your kick around t-shirt?
That is work and weather dependent.
Ah, fair enough. Okay. Yeah, this is a bad time of year for London, isn't it?
International break. Well, it's good for the work side of it. This was the tricky one this week, but next week is better because it's international break. But now the weather's gone completely bad. So we'll see. We don't want to. It's a white T-shirt. I can't be ruining this on the sort of smoky, oily, foul drops of things that come down from the sky in this city.
And we don't want a Lars Siverton wet T-shirt photo either.
Nobody wants that. I mean, yeah. I'd get cancelled right quick.
Right, by the Timbs or something like that. All right, the great Lars Siverton live from London in his home, and there's his dog in the background I can see on this video feed. What a handsome pup that guy is.
Yeah,
thank you, Lars. We appreciate the time. Thanks for playing the part of Andy today.
I guess I had great hanging out with you, and you know, I feel like I have spent some time with the listeners now as well. So I do appreciate all of you taking the time to listen to us talk about football.
Thank you, P1s. Thanks for listening. We love and adore you. Go on. Get out there, get stuck in, and win your 50s.